Yourself, you worked as a... This began when you went to Yale Law
School. That's right. I was a cottage parent in an institution for emotionally upset children.
I think we should perhaps explain this a bit. This was somewhere in Connecticut.
Yeah, this was in Connecticut. I was at Yale. I was one of six girls in the law school, and we weren't allowed to live in the beautiful quadrangle with the men. So we had a horrible old house that I found terribly depressing.
That's another subject we can talk about some other time, can't we? Discrimination against women.
Yes.
Which now is more and more, of course, become into the
floor. Yes, I understand now that the Yale Law students who were women will be allowed to live in the quad starting this September. The quad is just beautiful. But anyway, I felt very depressed and very isolated. So I wanted to change my place of living, and I couldn't afford the apartments in New Haven. So I looked in the paper, and there was an ad for a cottage parent, and they gave you housing, and they gave you food and meals and so forth. And I just thought I'd go look at the job. Well, when I went and I was shown the cottage that I would be living in, and I saw these 13 kids between the ages of 6 to 11, I just simply fell in love with them. You know, I didn't want to leave, so I took the job. And I worked there for 3 years while I was taking my law. And probably that was as important, that experience, as anything I ever learned in a book. Because every one of those 13 kids had committed one or more of those crimes that we were reading about in our criminal law casebook.
But now we come to you now. You're in Philadelphia.
Yes.
And you work in the district attorney's office.
I did for 10 years.
You did. No, I know. Don't we come to a question? What about your colleagues? Your attitude would not be that of a typical DA, would it?
I think that inside a lot of people feel this way, but sometimes because of their career involvements and so forth and their own political ambitions, they can't express it. The reason I left the district attorney's office was Vincent, that case. I didn't want to make the book a melodramatic autobiography, so I didn't put that in the book, but it was the district attorney's decision to prosecute this 13-year-old boy for first-degree murder for having murdered his parents. Having killed his parents.
As we're talking about Vincent, pardon me, I want to come to this in a moment. There's a parenthetical comment I've made now. As you and I are talking at this moment, there appears to be, a situation in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Yes.
Involving the murder of a number of girls.
Yes.
And there appears to be, again, this is a suspect who was a model boy in every way, gentle, kind, good. And so we think of Vincent.
Yes.
Or we think of the boy, for that matter, whom the father, the victim, wrote about.
Yes.
So, Vincent, first of all, what about your boss, the DA? Because your attitude was one of overwhelming compassion antisocial person.
What I felt was that the district attorney, like the Roman, should be the conscience of the community and not its megaphone. My boss did not have this view. He was running for re-election. He was a person who was very concerned about his own career. He has judicial ambitions. In fact, this year he's a candidate for a judgeship. And so he made what he thought was the easiest decision, which in the long run has turned out to be the hardest decision. For this reason, when the boy was arraigned in adult criminal court, his lawyer, whom I describe in the book, who was one of the great men that I have been privileged to know, decided he could not possibly take a chance with a jury.
This is Vincent now.
Yes, this is Vincent. His lawyer decided to throw him on the mercy of the court. And so there was a hearing before three judges. And these three judges, after reviewing all of the evidence in this case, which my office and I had painfully assembled, decided that they needed to put him away, but they put him away under a very peculiar sentence. There has been never another sentence like this in the history of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. They sentenced him for life.
You're talking about this case of Vincent and this remarkable punishment.
Yes, this remarkable sentence. Well, he's been now in confinement for 8 years, and as I point out in the book, he's really quite thoroughly rehabilitated. And I kept in touch with this boy all through because he had only an older brother who dropped out of the picture almost immediately. And about 2 years ago, he wrote and asked me if I would be his lawyer when the senator who represented him died. And I said yes, that I would. Now I discover that there's no record of this boy with the parole board of Pennsylvania because he was never sentenced as a criminal. And my problem is, you know, how to get him out of this machinery and how to get this record expunged in some way, because he has a conviction without, you know, he has the status without having had the right kind of ritual connected with the status. But this was a boy who was an altar boy. He had gone to, you know, parochial schools all his life. He was regarded in the neighborhood as a perfect boy. He helped his mother. He ran errands. He was polite and respectful. And all of a sudden, one morning at 7 o'clock, while his parents were still asleep, he got up with the gun that he had taken from his father's closet in his hand, and he pumped all the contents of that bullet cartridge into the sleeping bodies of both his parents and killed them both.
I think we have to go back into that. Well, first of all, his father had the loaded gun there to begin with.
That's
there was
right.
the gun. And the whole matter today, we deal with the matter of those who want guns in homes. But more important than that, we come to the question of the boy and his relationship to his parents and the question of sin.
Fantastic.
His mother's, that he had to be a pure boy.
Yes, well, you see, Studs, he had to be pure, but he wouldn't talk to us. When he came, when he was brought to my office, he was so agitated, he was so guilt-ridden, he knelt down, and he really wanted to die. He tried to kill himself by flinging himself against the walls of my office to bash out his brains. And he wouldn't tell us why he'd done it. But I knew that there had to be a reason, and so I asked the detectives who were working on the case from my office to go to the home, because I felt that within those four walls we would find the answer. When they got to the home, they discovered something absolutely incredible. They discovered that the upstairs sleeping quarters had no doors, that the bathroom had no door. And in the mother's sewing room, they found, and brought it to my office in boxes, the most unbelievable collection of hardcore pornography and erotica that I have ever seen. And having been in the district attorney's office, I've seen a lot of it. This was a collection that was just, you know, far-ranging and wide and detailed and obsessional. And it was then obvious to everyone who was working on the case that behind those lace curtains of that home and behind this facade, there had been a great deal of illness. And we then, with the skillful aid of a very marvelous psychiatrist, discovered that this boy had been seduced, that he had seen his parents having intercourse, that he had seen nudity, he had seen all this filth, he tried to burn it.
Over and beyond that, I mean, is it not, the horror is probably comes from the fact, not because of what you just described,
No.
But because of the whole facade
That's
of
right.
purity.
Yes, the confusion and the contradiction, and this is what I think is causing the trouble with children today. It's this confusion and contradiction in values that they see in contemporary society. People preaching one thing and doing another, demanding one kind of behavior from them and condoning behavior of another nature on the part of adults.
As you're talking, my eye fell upon another note I made here. Police emphasis on ghetto violence, Sergeant Sweeney's son. The very thing you're talking about now obviously cuts through all
layers
society.
Of society. That's right. This was a boy whose father was a distinguished police officer who engaged in drinking sprees in a park, and he four other boys actually stoned to death, like St. Stephen was stoned, a man who was a faggot whom they found in the park. They literally held this man at bay for 4 hours and took a vote as to whether or not to kill him. And these were middle-class boys with from fine homes, you know, and so forth. And I use that in my chapter on gangs because I wanted to show that this destructiveness that is in young people has nothing really to do with color or class.
Throughout the matter of the police and the young, perhaps during this conversation I might play a little piece of tape. Mm-hmm. This is a very good spot for it. You speak of this uneasy, there never is a truth, but there's an air between the police and the young of all stratus.
Yes,
the ghetto,
yes,
of course, but of all.
Yes, the ghetto kids call him the man or the fuzz, and the middle-class children also call him by that very name. There is a great hostility, and I must say that in many cases, it is engendered by the actions and the behavior of the police. In my chapter on the many flower children, I show how These children, many of whom were tragic runaways and kids who needed every bit of help a community could give them, were hounded and harassed out of the only place that they could sit quietly, the park in Philadelphia.
At this moment, if I may, I'll flip in this tape.
Good.
It's a lower middle class white community, west side of Chicago, and I'm talking to kids at St. Timothy's Parish. You may hear the voice of little Beverly. It's marvelous if we hear that. She's about 11, skinny little kid. Police car's following her all the way home. So she went to go buy an ice cream cone. And then comes a certain moment, ask a certain question, and you'll hear it. Listen to part of it.
This is the tape, by the way. I'm filling in. I did not bring. This is a tape at St. Timothy's Parish, an encounter I had some 3-4 years ago with a group of about 10 or 11 children of the community from the ages of about 9 to about 13. And the skinny little blonde kid, Beverly, is talking in a little voice about the police car following her. And he says, "Where are you going?" She says, "I'm going to buy an ice cream cone and buy a paper for my father." She says, "Well, you go on, get home now, we'll pull you in." And in that story, of course, in that particular anecdote that seems humorous, at the same time has overtones, here's the enemy. Again, the question of the young. The suspected young, no matter in what status of society they are. And later on, I asked the kids a question, how they felt about police. These are lower middle class white kids. And they all, I says, "Friend or enemy?" Just as a little game plays kids. And they all hollered, "Enemy." And this is, again, a symptom of our day. It has nothing to do, in this instance, with race. It has to do, though, with something else, old, young, and that gap. And so we continue the conversation with Mrs. Richette.
Well, this particular aspect, do you trust the police? The answer is no on the part of these many. We come to something obviously quite cockeyed with society today. The attitude of authority in the form of the adult toward that young person of all,
yes,
of all the strata of
that's
society.
Right. That's right. This is what concerns me, and this is why I want more and more lawyers to get involved in the defense of these young people. And because it's only with the adversary system, it's only when you have the police on the defensive, if I may say so, that you get the best that is within them to express itself. Otherwise, left unchecked and uncontrolled, they really run rampant.
Then you have a question of the apathetic, of the, again, quote-unquote, respectable.
Yeah.
And flight from freedom, acceptance.
Yeah.
Because somewhere here, I said flight from freedom because, again, my eye fell upon a note on page 101. When the child runs off, act of flight, you also call a dash for life.
It is.
A Huck Finn.
Yes, it is. Yes, yes. I think that we do a great, great damage when we punish children for running away. We ought to bring them back, yes, because they need to have a safe place to live and grow up in. But we should work with them and find out what this runaway really meant to them and how we can answer their problems so that they don't have to keep running and running and running. But I represent children who run away once a month. And they'll call me up and they'll say, "I ran away again, and here I am." And, you know,
I never got you to finish that story about Vincent and why it was. So Vincent was given this unusual punishment.
Yes.
And you were with the DA at the
yes,
time.
Yes, I was outvoted 4-1. My feeling was that this boy should be tried in juvenile court, and he should be treated as a sick boy and not as a criminal. And I lost. And
your colleagues are out to make a record, obviously.
I think so, and that I tell it in that chapter exactly the way it happened. The hawks outnumbered, you know, that dove in the office. And I left. And I left wrote a long letter to the district attorney, which a newspaper reporter got hold of and ran on the front page of the bulletin in Philadelphia. But I left because I felt that at that moment I could no longer be part of a machinery and a system which could take a 13-year-old boy in the year 1962 and treat him exactly the way Hanging Judge Jeffreys would have treated him in 19th century England. You know, this was not my scene, and this was not what I was about. So I left, and I opened my own practice to represent children. This is before Gault, and my friend said to me, "You're out of your mind. You know, you won't have any clients."